Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. We need to continue to learn, pray, act as we appeal to heaven. We need to be focused on constitutional compliance. And as a matter of fact, we go out of our way to teach this to your legislators. We just had a county legislative session or presentation this week. And so just today. And it's interesting because you can kind of do a litmus test on the types of politicians that are sitting there representing you. You need to understand who is really representing you, because those who care, I mean, those who come forward and testify, oh, the pandemic really showed me that, you know, we've got a government that, you know, that is not the government we're supposed to have. And unfortunately, the illiteracy is just amazing. This is why we go out of our way to educate you on what is constitutional, all of these source documents, what we need to do, why the framers did what they did. Those of you who are learning, that are, you know, actually going through these things, you have a great opportunity to help those who are in service, or you have even a better opportunity to actually step in and replace those who are failing you. So, you know, there's the stick and the carrot, right? There is the carrot that entices them. If you want to stay in office, you need to do this. But to be honest with you, nobody feels the threat of the stick. So the carrot doesn't have any luster, because people would rather have a fine chocolate, maybe a German or Swiss chocolate. We have to help them understand that their position, their paradigm, is unacceptable. They're way too busy. They're not going to take the time to read. They're not going to take the time to learn. There are very few that do. When I say they're not going to, I'm generalizing, which means that the majority of every person in office, we've ran into and work with those who are actually learning. Some of the problems we run into, it has to do more with the oblique attacks that we get from these other organizations who are literally struggling to maintain their grasp and control over these people. We don't want to control your leaders. We do not want to control those representatives in your county, your state, and even in Congress. We want them to do their job and stick to the powers delegated. And therefore, we can all go back to doing what we need to do. I'm not here to control them. But when we look at some of these organizations, and my favorite being the John Birchers, you know, they just want to have the soul, they want to maintain the monopoly on the ear of those who they have. And sadly, this is only because they lose relevance when we actually get our government or our representatives to do what they're supposed to do. They're not interested in solving the problem. The problem is what keeps their butts alive. It's what keeps the doors of the John Birchers, the 10th Amendment, all these myopic organizations. And yes, the John Birchers are myopic. They've made themselves myopic because they've gone into the camp of becoming the anti-conventionites instead of the Constitution provides all the solutions. The Constitution's not the problem. So instead, they had to, and they felt that their best place was to fight and create a binary argument which would keep the state legislatures from actually doing what they're supposed to do. Oh, but yeah, they recommend nullification. That doesn't solve the problem. We cover all these paths. So when it comes time to actually start getting action out of our public servants. It's only going to be when they create these committees, because the reality is this, folks. There may be a few that'll get smart. The rest of them will be either informed or slightly educated from these committees. These committees are going to be the citizens' juries. These committees are going to be the subject matter experts on the Constitution in every county and in every state legislature. And as I was just talking to somebody about this, I was talking to my sister in Christ, Michelle, that when we actually get these people to put aside their political agendas, put aside their party, their focus on all of these little agendas, and to actually start focusing on full compliance and getting government into the scope of the Constitution, they're going to shift from a manager to a leader. Because politicians today, every politician in office is managing agendas, right? They have this little, you know, I'll call it a cheat sheet that they get from the constituents. You need to bring us jobs. You need to combat this. You need to and none of it is going to solve the real problem so government will get back into the scope of the Constitution. If they start leading and the people start, because when the people start learning from these committees, this creates a symbiotic relationship and actually creates a movement within the county and within the state. And when you have a movement, now you have a fire that can't be put out. But when you have a myopic movement, the length of the twig, the length of the problem is going to, that fire's only going to get so high it can't jump, and it's stuck. It's stuck on that little branch it's on. Well, we're just here fighting the, you know, Second Amendment laws, or, you know, laws to take away our Second Amendment rights. Well, that doesn't deal with all the rest of the problems, which is why we, you know, try to use these memes or these overviews so that you can actually see, wow, that's a huge problem. Because everything they're doing without authority is a part of the problem. So anyway, the intent is to create the Thomas Jeffersons, the Roger Shermans, the James Madisons, the leaders of the future who actually want to see the liberty of the people restored and the limited and defined government, or the getting our government back into the limited and defined scope that the Constitution has created. Now, technically, if you haven't read Why Counties Matter Most, one of the things you're going to get from that document, from that article, is that the states they have so many problems. One of the biggest problems is your counties have not been instituted by we the people. We have failed to actually institute our very own government. And in so doing, when we created the state government, the state government has this paradigm that they're the grand poobah of all the counties. In other words, the child really believes that they're the parents of the counties when the counties created the child. It's the same thing with the federal government. The federal government believes they're the parent of all. And actually, folks, when you look at the relationship, we the people, as Madison was stating, we the people are the parents. We're the parents of our government, the government that we create in our vicinage for us and the communities that serve, so that this government serves the communities and our interests. Then the other communities, they have their own government. And then you get all of these communities we call counties, and you basically throughout the state then create a state government to serve the interests of the counties. When the counties went into creating the state constitution, they didn't do it right. They didn't do it so that they would ensure that the state government would understand that they're there to serve the sovereignty of the people and to protect it, as well as the sovereignty of the county government or the people's government, and to protect it and to protect their interests from the encroachments of other counties or what have you. So, It's all about constitutional compliance. Now, when we wrapped up on Friday, I pretty much kind of went down this, you know, this long line. And so the whole point that I think most people still have a problem, and there's just no way I'm going to be able to give you the clarity on what common law is going to be for you. This is where the people of your community literally need to come up with what they want to do. Now, I believe that common law around the United States is going to kind of gravitate, you know, in a single direction for most all counties. There is no common law at the state, and you do not want to have common law courts at the state level. Why? Because you don't want to have to go have your divorce at the state, even though the state may actually have these opportunities of, you know, county seats, what have you, that you can get that divorce that way. But you don't actually, if you don't give it to the state, then we the people keep it. Now, in the county, I think what we need to do is actually tailor the county law or the legal system to obviously have an interface, you know, a court that interfaces with the state constitution, so that those matters that fall arise under that constitution, we are dealing with the state on those matters. But I believe we need to actually re-examine and go back to the true meaning of common law, where we no longer have these formal courts. In other words, when we really look at common law, you don't have to have a paid judge. It's kind of like, well, everybody wants money for everything. And so this is why I think it's going to take time to really, the easy way is to give your county the jurisdiction of common law and keep it at the county court and separate it from the state court, so that nothing can go outside of the county regarding common law. Your traffic tickets, your what have you, your, you know, divorces, contracts, those types of things. Because that's what common law is. That's what common law is to be maintained. Same thing with the criminal law. So, as we look at this, you know, this description, or where are we going to get the Blackstone commentaries? Technically, I think the Blackstone commentaries is a book that needs to be written that provides, you know, the framework of how common law is not a part of the U.S. Constitution or the state constitution, and help everybody understand not constitutional law, but the contract law as applied by the contracts. In other words, every state should have its own commentaries on the contract law of the compact. In other words, because states will have different powers, ultimately that's what we're going to end up creating if we do what we need to do, if we get this done. Your state may actually have different powers than all the other states. And so as we lay that out, the commentaries on the compact law, on, you know, this contract law of the compact, then that's what we're talking about, the commentaries on the law for your state and the federal government, how your framework, how you are interfacing. Because remember, the federal government was created to interface with all of the different states' forms of law. They are to adapt to serve the states. They're not to direct the states that you have to do this. As a matter of fact, the Constitution, I've said this so many times, the Constitution would have been rejected had the Constitution inflicted a specific form of government other than Republican. At that point in time, all the framers and everybody was affixed on it must be a Republican form of government, not a judiciary, not an executive or monarchy, a Republican form of government. So as we lay out this commentary for your state, then within your state, is basically how most of the counties will dictate their common law. In other words, how will the people get their divorces? Now, will divorces actually be handled? Will there be such a thing as marriage by common law? Will the county be able to issue marriage licenses? If you want to get married, and the county wants, or the people of the county wants to make sure that marriage is maintained by, you know, established religions, because marriage comes from religion, then okay, then you don't allow the county, you can't get married unless you go to an established religion. However you want to do it, because what'll end up happening is, you know, this is going to go down this path, because I had this conversation on Friday, Saturday, where we were working, I was working with a gentleman who has, you know, who's a religious leader, and he was very concerned because he was talking to a group of people in New York, and they were talking about, you know, working with people who weren't Christian. And they didn't want to work with people who were Christian. Or I should say, the Christians didn't want to work with people who weren't Christian. In other words, they're already creating these factions that we have to do this with Christ. As I have said time and time again, prove me wrong. I believe the only omnipotent entity is our Creator. And I believe our Creator knew the circumstances of today, that we have less than 50%, less than 50% people who have strong convictions with their religion, which means that the majority of the people are either secular or they're not in that boat of, you know, being identified as qualified to be working with these hardline Christian people who want to have a theocracy. Because when you go down this path of saying, well, this has all got to be done with, you know, religiously, spiritually, that right there is setting the stage of walking into the arms of a theocracy, or focusing in restoring theocracy, which is precisely what the Constitution is not. The Constitution protects the theocracies of the individuals, the individual churches, and so forth, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have a theocracy at your state. You can. In your county, if you're going to create a theocracy, you create it for your county. You do not want it to go to the state, because then there's a good chance that the seculars will actually win. There are some red states that may not. But those states that actually have the secular, if you give the state that ability. So this is where the conservatives, these red counties, because, folks, look at every state in the union. Every state in the union has a majority of red counties. So the red counties can, at the Constitutional Convention, in reframing that state constitution, The thing you want to do is you don't want the state to be involved in religion. You don't want it to be involved in education. You don't want it to be involved in all of these things where they can start doing social engineering. You don't want to give them that door. Because once they open it, they're going to prop it open, and they're just going to start creating a little highway into every aspect of your life that they could possibly use that in, from that door that you've given them. Therefore, what you want to do is you can, if you want to, you can create a theocracy. You can create a doctrine of magistrate as long as it's republican in form. Remember, the U.S. Constitution does not dictate how that republican in form government is to be. But experience has proven to us. Empirical data lays out that the best government is a government that has checks and balances. The Constitution, the federal Constitution, is the exemplar. By limiting government's involvement in all of these aspects, especially a general government, your state government, you want to limit that, just like the federal government. Give it a little more power to be able to serve the county's interests for commerce purposes, because the federal government doesn't have that. and to what level you want them to be involved in commerce, transportation, these domestic things that the federal government should not have. And the question is, do you want to create a consortium or a Congress or a separate governing body, a governing board over specific domestic matters like infrastructure between the states? Congress doesn't have the authority. We don't want to give it to them. We do not want to amend the Constitution so they have that. I've gone down this rat hole, going from common law and creating these commentaries on our legal system. But it all stems from, because it's all about your Constitution. It all stems from that county and state Constitution. This is why you need to create your county Constitution first. And you're going to have to kick the tires on it. And what you want to avoid is you want to avoid people that want to create a platitude in their Constitution. Platitudes, I should say. Where, you know, we, you know, want to have our own Bill of Rights and so forth. I believe that allowing the U.S. Constitution to protect us from all infringements on all rights, either enumerated or not enumerated, because the U.S. Constitution with the Ninth Amendment protects us from all those rights that aren't enumerated. We don't need to try to create the comprehensive list. Which is why the 14th Amendment protects the people from the state government and your county government. So they can't make or enforce any law that abridges your privileges and immunities, including those non-enumerated rights. So why would you want to go down and create this haughty constitution that says, oh, we're Christian, we're going to protect this right? Because down the road, there's going to be a level of technology, there's going to be a shift, a paradigm shift, that government will say, oh, look, you didn't include this, and now we created it, and now we can use this to come after you. It's kind of like when they're using businesses today to spy on you. Even though businesses aren't direct corporations and businesses are not direct government bodies, they are accountable to government. And they are working, and they're accountable to foreigners, they're accountable to foreign interests and government interests and so forth, which is why the fact that if they have your private data and they're sharing that, they're violating your Fourth Amendment right to be secure in your person. And the online, all these online businesses, these cookies, all of these things are actually violating your rights. So do you really want to go down the path of doing this, you know, this long Bill of Rights and giving your county general powers? Instead, let's give them the powers that we want them to have. But we got to get it right. And oh, the great thing is that we can inject an amendment process. Do not make the mistake that the amendment process only requires 50%. You make that mistake and then you've basically unleashed mob rule. What would that mean? Well, it would, and this is exactly how the Soroses did this over the past few decades. They would actually send in a team of young students regarding the homosexual marriage. And in Washington State, it was like 1,000 or something like that. They sent in to basically assign them to be around the high schools, community colleges, you know, and these institutions of learning for the young people. Because most young people weren't getting out to vote. And they made this a young person initiative to basically legalize homosexual marriage. Now, on its own merits, had everything followed the regular process with a supreme majority, in other words, 2/3 majority required. And as a matter of fact, in your state constitution, we'll get back to this, in your state constitution, you want to make sure that it's not just a majority of the counties. You want to have a super majority, like 2/3 of the counties that ratify it, not a majority of people. So we'll come right back and talk about Soros and how we did that. And then I'm just going to wrap up so that we can dive into this last portion of this document of the Land Act. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so when you create a mob rule, then this is why I was going down this path of Soros. What they do is they get people to move. It's very easy to just take up a new domicile into another county so that they can actually start tipping that county and getting bad governors in, bad legislators in, as well as tipping the vote based on county. You notice that these dark, dark red counties have very low population. These big blue counties have much higher. So they can actually calculate how many they need to move so that they can play those games. So when we talked about this about 5 years ago, because it was in 2020 when we were talking about the initial campaign and the Bill of Rights for the 21st century, one critical thing that we need to actually place into the Constitution is making sure that we make all elections local and that we make it difficult. We make it difficult for a person to be able to vote in local elections. It's one thing to vote in the state and or the federal election. However, when one person moves from one district to another, then before their ability to vote in that election, they should actually be required to be there for a while regarding representation. It's the same thing with voters when they, I should say immigrants, they have to become a citizen. The process of moving shouldn't really affect, I'll just say, the state representation. But when it comes to the county representation, when it comes to these statewide initiatives and so forth, you want to make sure that that person that has actually set up that domicile is actually in that domicile. And as a matter of fact, one of the things you want to do before you amend your constitution is to account for, what's a good word for it? I'll call them fleas, because this happens in dark, dark red states. Wyoming is always victim of this because the state allows the Republicans and the Democrats to cross lines, and they play around and they vote in other districts by these, what do they call those? The types of, it's a ballot. It's a provincial ballot or whatever, where they aren't necessarily in that county, but on election day, they're in this other county, so they cast their ballot there. And in so doing, they're voting on all the local issues and so forth. So this is how they undermine our election process. We have to come up, and I don't say I have all of the answers, but we actually have to make sure that we have the ability to protect ourselves from people playing these games. This came up in the ratification debates. Massachusetts talked about how it could be easy for a group of immigration, or I should say migrants, to migrate from one state into another during an election to basically undermine that state. And nobody ever talks about this, but we have to actually put measures in where, we can have measures of protection. So, in other words, maybe, and I'm just throwing this out, maybe if a person moves into your county, they vote in your county, but then their permanent domicile changes again, they go to another county, then the vote that they cast should not actually count because they weren't a permanent resident. They didn't become a permanent resident. Therefore, the effects of a constitutional amendment would require probably, you know, the election to occur for the passing of the amendment and a two-year period to ensure that those people who voted for that, that they were legitimate, permanent resident votes. Now, there's probably all sorts of little problems with it, but we have technology that can actually help keep track of all of these things so that we can actually determine whether that person... Now, the unsavory part of this is it requires some level of personal engagement. And I believe that when you want to become a voter, you actually have to give up the fact of where you're living and, you know, it doesn't matter about the party or anything else, but where you're living at that very current point in time. Because that's when the clock starts and that's when the clock, you know, stops. If you move, then the clock stops from that point. And what that means is you didn't meet the prerequisites. You didn't meet the required permanent residency to be able to vote for that amendment. What we want to do, and there's probably better ways of doing this, but what we need to do is we need to figure out how to defend ourselves from people, these kings, these self-appointed and anointed gods, these demigods that have established themselves in America, who are foreigners or they are subjects of the globalist movement trying to constantly undermine us. Now, it is my opinion that those people that are here in America, if we actually get back to where we need to be, they shouldn't even be here. Gates should be gone. His money should be taken from him, his estate, his assets. All of these people who are here in America, who are actually waging an insurgency, they become the subjects of the Toryaks, the 22nd century or the 21st century Toryaks, where we actually say, if you're actively engaged in waging an insurgency against the Constitution, you lose your citizenship. If you are using your resources, affluence, and everything else to wage this insurgency, it's one thing to be out there, you know, in the streets, campaigning, petitioning, what have you. But it's another thing when you're using your money, you're funding organizations and so forth, then that is absolutely unacceptable. We cannot allow insurgencies against the Constitution to persist, folks. We can't. Every person is legally obligated. Every citizen is legally obligated. You can be stripped of, and this is where we really want to go down this path because I think the framers really failed on this as well. And the state nationals are literally jumping into the fire if we actually do this right. Because if you're not a U.S. citizen, you don't get due process. If you're not a U.S. citizen, you can't vote. If you're not a U.S. citizen, then you don't have any say. And if you're not a U.S. citizen and you try to influence using your money, using your businesses or resources, you may be an inhabitant. But if you're using your businesses for things that actually violate the Constitution, then you and your things, basically, you'll be kicked out, you'll be deported, and your things will be stripped from you, your property and so forth. This is where we actually have to cut our ties from the global banks, all of these things that we've created. So... This seems like it's a big nightmare, but actually, when we start shifting back, there are methods and processes that we actually will have to put into place to restore our gold and silver currency so that we can't have an inflated currency. We have the ability to go back to these things, and there's no reason why we can't actually do this. The real question is, folks, is the elixir, is the poison, is the bitterness of the elixir worth the solution, or are we better off losing everything? In other words, allowing the globalists to basically subject us, where we lose everything. And I'm telling you that the brighter minds will prevail if we actually move forward in demanding full compliance and how to fix those things. Because you got to remember, we've been defrauded by foreigners. We've been defrauded by our own people. Those people, not that I'm not saying they can't be, they should be brought to justice. All things, all justice must be served. But before we can get justice, we actually have to get right with the Constitution. We have to get right at the state, at the county, state, and federal level. That's why it starts at your county. So, where we kind of left off on these land acts, because I was just in the very last throes of this, I want to kind of wrap this up today. We were in Section 7. We just wrapped up Section 7 with this part. But that, so that's halfway through, and it's highlighted. So this is where we left off. But that if it shall be duly discharged, the purchaser or his assignee or other legal representative shall be entitled to a patent for and the said lands. Now, just taking a quick aside or a quick pause, all you've got to do is go back to where we left off and then pick up the same document, and now we're back to this. So when you're going through the content, you need to make sure that you go, you can miss all of these diatribes, all of these rants that I do. That way you're focused on just obtaining. And so today's show, in the comments, I'll basically say the last half is when we dove into this. So that way you don't have to listen and waste a lot of time to learn the content. And send on and go moving on. And on payment of the said balance to the Treasury within the specified time, and producing to the Secretary of State a receipt for the same upon the aforesaid certificate, the President of the United States is hereby authorized to grant a patent for the lands of the said purchaser, his heirs or assigns, and all patents shall be countersigned by the Secretary of State and recorded in his office. But if there should be a failure in any payment, the sale shall be void, all of the money thereto for paid on account of the purchase shall be forfeited to the United States, and the lands thus sold shall be again disposed of in the same manner as if the sale had never been made, provided nevertheless that should any purchaser make payment of the whole purchase money at the time when the payment of the first monety is directed to be made, he shall be entitled to a reduction of 10% of the part of which credit is hereby directed to be given, and his patent shall be immediately issued. Section 8. Be it further enacted. Now, I just want to make sure you do understand that the president doesn't have this role, this power. There's no amendment to the Constitution granting him this role to be able to issue these patents. And as a matter of fact, the federal government doesn't have the ability to even create these patents for these states. This is only territories. Everything the federal government is doing gets wiped out as that state actually comes in. So what has to happen is this all has to be done. The federal government has the ability to sell the land and make needful regulations, but it has to basically turn that all over, and the state takes full cognizance over all of those patents, titles, whatever they want to call them. But see, this became a permanent control at the federal government's level. This power is not within the federal government. Section 8. Be it further enacted that the Secretary of the Treasury and the Governor of the Territory northwest of the Ohio River shall respectively cause books to be kept in which shall be regularly entered an account of the dates of the sales made and situation and numbers of the lots sold and price at which each was struck off, the money deposited at the time of sale, and the dates of the certificates granted to the different purchasers. The governor or secretary of the said territory shall at every suspension or adjournment for more than 3 days of the sales under their directions transmit to the Secretary of the Treasury a copy of the said books certified to have been duly examined, compared with the original, and all tracts sold under this act shall be noted upon the general plat after the certificate has been granted to the purchaser, and it be further enacted that all navigable rivers within the territory to be disposed of by the virtue of this act shall be deemed and to remain in public highways, and that in all cases where the opposite banks of any streams not navigable shall belong to different persons, the stream and the bed thereof shall become common to both. Now, just pausing here. Again, for them to come up with a national system of management of every plot of land and every deed, every title, and every patent, they have to have this power in Article 1, Section 8. It's not enumerated. Ergo, this is how they said, hey, you know what, we already assume that without amending the Constitution, so we're going to just take it and change it so that you really don't ever own your land. We're not giving you patents. We're creating this thing. They're playing with words. We're going to create this title. We're going to create this deed, whatever they want to use to say, well, that's your land, and you kind of own it, but you don't. You're going to have to pay taxes on it, because once you own your land, you don't pay taxes, per se, federal taxes. But technically, when you really look at the apportionments were based on persons, not land. And so if the state wanted to create state taxes on land, that would have to be within their state constitution. The people get to decide, you know, how they're going to get their pound of flesh. We cannot create a government without actually, you know, sustaining it. In other words, you always have to keep in mind that whatever you're giving that government, you have to be able to pay them to do or give them the power and money and those things necessary for them to succeed. It has to be sustainable. And if you don't have the tax base, you don't have the mechanisms to be able to do that, then you need to start taking things away from them so that they don't, you know, they don't have a fire department. They don't have, you know, these other public services or what have you. But governments must be sustainable. So Section 10, and it be further enacted that the surveyor general shall receive for his compensation $2,000 per annum, and that the President of the United States may fix the compensation of the assistant surveyors, chain carriers, and axemen, provided that the whole expense of surveying and marking the lines shall not exceed $3 per mile for every mile that shall be actually run or surveyed. And it be further enacted that the following fees shall be paid for the services to be done under this act to the Treasurer of the United States or to the receiver of the Western Territory, as the case may be, for each certificate for a tract containing a quarter of a township, $20, for a certificate for a tract containing 640 acres, $6 for each patent for a quarter of township, $20 for a section of 640 acres, $6 and fees shall be accounted for by the receivers respectively. So they're just laying out how they're going to basically capture the money to cover the costs. Because at this point in time, and I'm just trying to remember where we are, I believe at this point in time, as we look at this, this is 1796. So this is after the first Continental Congress had actually started having these conversations of doing this. So this means that this act, if it was 1796, this means that this act was something that was being passed by Congress where they were actually doing things they had no authority to do. Section 11, and be it further enacted that the following fee shall be paid for the services to be done under this act to the Treasurer of the United States or to the receiver in the Western Territories, as the case may be, for each certificate for the tract containing a quarter of township, $20 for a certificate of a tract containing 640 acres, and for each patent for a quarter of township, $20. For a section of 640 acres, $6, and the said fees shall be accounted for by the receivers respectively. And so the 12th section is, and it shall be further enacted that the surveyor, general assistant surveyors and chain carriers shall, before they enter on the several duties to be performed under this act, severally take an oath or affirmation faithfully to perform the same, and the same to be appointed to receive money on sales in the Western Territories before he shall receive any money under this act, shall give bond with sufficient security for the faithful discharge of his trust, that for receiving, safekeeping, and conveying to the Treasury the money he may receive shall be entitled to compensation hereafter fixed. Now, this shall give bond is unconstitutional unless this is something that is a character of employment, because they're actually talking about employees who are going to be on contract. In other words, they're hiring these people to do a very specific job. So this may be a individual labor contract that stands out, that these aren't become permanent federal surveyors that they're going to retire. There's no retirement funds back in these days. So there may be this requirement that they have to give bond to actually kind of cover, you know, the liabilities of their skipping town or what have you. That may be that that's something that's okay. But if they're requiring anybody to come in service of the United States, like going into office or being elected, that they have to give a bond, then that's unconstitutional for a Congress, because they can't, one, require states to do this. Secondly, they cannot require a member of the House of Representatives or the Senate or even a judge to give bond. It needs to be in the Constitution as a requirement of service. It's a part of the standard that they have to be able to give bond. The Act of February 11th, 1805, this is Second Statute 313, Chapter 14, an act concerning the mode of surveying the public lands of the United States. A, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled, that the Surveyor General shall cause all those lands north of the River Ohio, which by virtue of the act entitled, an act providing for the sale of lands of the United States in the territory northwest of the River Ohio, and there's this little asterisk, the provision of this asterisk, of this act of Congress, now codified in Title 43 of the United States Code, are still the statute laws of the land and brought the public land surveys to the basic system still in use. Even though some of the provisions are obsolete, reprinted by the United States statutes at large, blah, blah, blah. So moving back down to the last couple of pages here. And the mouth of the River Kentucky were subdivided by running through the townships parallel lines each way at the end of every 2 miles and by marking a corner on each of the said lines at the end of every mile, to be subdivided into sections by running straight lines from the mile corners thus marked to the opposite corresponding corners, and by marking on each of the said lines intermediate corners as nearly as possible equidistant from the corners of the sections on the same. And the said surveyor general shall also cause the boundaries of all the half sections which had been purchased before previously to the day of July and on which the surveying fees had been paid according to law by the purchaser to be surveyed and marked by running straight lines from the half-mile corners heretofore marked to the opposite corresponding corners and the immediate corners shall at the same time be marked on each of the said dividing lines as possibly equidistant from the corners of the half-section on the same line, providing that the whole expenses of surveying and marking the line shall not exceed $3 for every mile which has not been surveyed and which shall be actually be ran, surveyed, and marked. I don't think they're paying $3 a mile anymore, right? And one of the things that's worth pointing out is what they're doing is they're actually just getting into the minutiae, the detail of the process of surveying, and they're laying it out and how the compensation will be limited. So they have to do this. They have to do it efficiently. And by doing it efficiently, they can actually make their maximum amount, which would be $3 a mile. Section 2, I'm just going to skip over that. Section 2, and it be further enacted that the boundaries and contents of the several sections, half sections, and quarter sections of the public lands of the United States shall be ascertained to conformity with the following principles, any act be ascertained or acts to the contrary notwithstanding. First, all corners marked in the surveys returned by the Surveyor General or by the Surveyor of the land south of the state of Tennessee, respectively, shall be established by the proper corners of sections or subdivisions of sections which they were intended to designate, and the corners of half and quarter sections not marked on the said surveys shall be placed as nearly as possible equidistant from those two corners which stand on the same line. Second, or 2D, subparagraph 2D. The boundary lines actually run and mark the surveyors by the Surveyor General. I got 2 minutes to do this, and there's very little left. They're basically laying out exactly how the land is to be surveyed, how the costs are, and how everything is to be fixed. And so, bottom line, this, as we look at what they're doing, it's not that they didn't have the responsibility of either selling land while it was transitioning to a state, but the fact that the federal government owned and controlled any land that was within a state is absolutely repugnant to the Constitution. So we haven't found the actual debates in Congress. We've gone through the first year of the debates in Congress. And I have proven to you that they still have not laid out how they're going to assume the land or the selling of this land and being able to do this. To me, they have the ability to dispose of land by selling it and make needful regulations while it's a territory. But once that territory becomes a state, everything transitions to that state, period. And so how is it that the states today, the existing states, at the same time, how are they selling land? Did they have the Surveyor General come in to do it? Did they assume this? I'm going to tell you, the states, I'm sure, Virginia, New York, they weren't going to let the federal government come in and sell that land and take the money for it. That was a sovereign state. This is where they started changing and affixing the paradigm unconstitutionally to powers not delegated. When a state joins the union, it becomes an independent sovereign state, and it has its own responsibilities of disposing its own land and managing the ownership of the land and only allowing citizens to actually own land. So, this was approved February 11th, 1805. So with that, what we're going to do, actually, I got to look at my list over here. What are we going to cover next? So we just covered the Land Act. So I think what we're going to cover next are the regulating deposits of the public money, which was in 1836 under Andrew Jackson and Van Buren. Folks, I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.